Welcome to the Power of Purpose Summit, a five-day global event sponsored by the Mankind Project USA. Visit us online at mkpusa.org. Chris Kyle speaks with Bill Plotkin in a session titled Two Kinds of Life Purpose, Societal and Soulful.
Welcome, everyone, to the Power of Purpose Summit. If you're joining us for the first time, my name is Chris Kyle, and I'm your co-host for this global online event exploring how to live with greater purpose and deeper meaning in our lives. I'm really glad you're here with us, and I'm so excited to welcome Bill Plotkin to our summit today. Let me tell you a little bit about Bill before we dive in with Bill so you get to know a bit about him before we start. So Bill is a depth psychologist, he's a wilderness guide, and what he likes to call an agent of cultural evolution, which is awesome. I love that term. As founder of the Southwest Colorado's Animas Valley Institute, he has since 1980 guided thousands of women and men through nature-based initiatory passages, including a contemporary Western adaptation of the pan-cultural vision fast. He's also been a research psychologist, a professor of psychology, a rock musician, I want to hear about that, and whitewater river guide. In 1979, on a solo winter ascent of an Adirondack mountain, Bill experienced a call to spiritual adventure, leading him to abandon academia in search of his true calling. Bill is the author of Soulcraft, Crossing into the Mysteries of Nature and Psyche, Nature and the Human Soul, Cultivating Wholeness and Community in a Fragmented World, and his most recent book, which is called Wild Mind, A Field Guide to the Human Psyche. Bill also holds a doctorate in psychology from the University of Colorado at Boulder, and he also lives in Colorado. So it is my pleasure and honor to welcome you, Bill, to the Power of Purpose Summit.
Thanks so much, Chris. It's great to join you.
Yeah, and really interesting background that you have, Bill. I'm drawn to it as well, as a man that loves to live out in nature a lot and had a variety of experiences and very interested in the human psyche and life purpose. So I'm excited to just dive into this topic with you today. And so my first question to you, Bill, just to get us into this, is I've noticed in your writings that you really have a unique take on life purpose. So how do you hold or define purpose?
Yeah, good question. I've come to understand that we have at least two kinds of purposes. Actually, maybe three, but probably two will be plenty to get into today. And the first kind is what I think most people think of as life purpose, which is, I call it a social purpose. It has to do with our social role or our vocation or a particular art or craft or science that we pursue, a particular way of being in the human community. And that seems to be, these days, when I hear people talking about purpose, they mean some variety of that kind of thing, which I call social purpose. But as I've been studying various literature and traditions over the last 30 or 40 years, I've come to recognize that there's a more mystical kind of purpose that every human being has. And I call it the soul purpose, S-O-U-L. It's on a quite an entirely different level than social purpose. Our soul purpose is, as I say, it's mystical. It's the secret or the essence of our mythopoetic identity. I use that term mythopoetic partly because other people do too, but it combines the words both myth and poetry, and the implication here is that we're each born to live a certain kind of mysterious or mystical story in the world, and that's a mythic story, using the word myth, of course, in the original sense of the deepest truths of our lives, the sacred truths, not in the more shallow contemporary sense of myth meaning something that's not true. It actually means the opposite. It's the deepest truth. And the poetic part of mythopoetic points to the fact that our soul purpose is experienced by us and communicated to us and by us in terms of metaphor or image or symbol or dream experiences or dream-like experiences or what the Jungians would call archetypes, the images of the gods and goddesses. And so, and this experience of soul purpose, again, it's on a very different level. And once we understand our mythopoetic identity or our soul purpose, then the question becomes, how are we going to embody that or manifest it or express it in our lives? And we do that through some kind of social role or some kind of profession or vocation. So before we have an understanding of our soul purpose or mystical purpose, we might have an understanding of a social purpose. But once we've had the revelation or the visionary experience of our mythopoetic identity, then the prior social purpose may or may not be something that we continue embodying in our life. But if we do, it's no longer, we wouldn't call it our soul purpose, our purpose at that point. We'd call it our delivery system. It's the way, it's the social or vocational ways and settings in which we embody our more mystical purpose. I can give you some examples if you'd like, if we have time. But
yeah, I
wanted to start out with that distinction. Very, very different sort of things between these two kinds of purposes. So that what I call the journey of soul initiation is actually something that has been mostly missing from the Western world for at least several hundred and maybe a few thousand years. And you find it in the mystery schools, but you don't find it in any of the mainstream traditions anymore. So really important distinction at the heart of my work.
And so when you talk about this dance between social purpose and soul purpose, how do you see them tie? Is there an order in your mind of needing to, let's say, start with the investigation of soul purpose? Is that what your invitation is, or is it just you're on your social purpose and then you may have an experience that moves you into soul purpose? What's your sort of take or ordering on the exploration for somebody there?
Yeah, I've come to see things developmentally, and part of the work I've done is create a stage model of healthy human life with 8 stages that we go through if we live long enough and if we progress well. And there are some stages to go through before we're really even ready psychologically and spiritually for the discovering our soul purpose, which in that adventure entails the what's often called the journey to soul or the descent to the underworld. So there's foundational work that we need to do, as especially as contemporary Western humans, before we're even ready for the descent to soul. And we go through these stages, and obviously in childhood we all have a purpose, but it tends to be the same, roughly the same kind of purpose in childhood, where for me, I understand it as our purpose as children is to understand the culture, the people that we're from, and become one of them. And also equally important is to understand the web of life experientially, the earth community that we're part of, and to find ourselves, experience ourselves as full members of the Earth community. So that's as children. Then we reach our teen years. Of course, as everyone knows, our purpose becomes social acceptance and finding the peer group that we fit in best and understanding what it is to be a sexual creature and to navigate that world of sexuality. But at some point in our development, maybe in our teen years, maybe in our 20s, we start asking other questions about purpose. And they might be questions on the order of, how do I contribute to my community, to my people, and or what's my job going to be, or my profession? And in the Western world, we usually spend quite a number of years, if not the rest of our lives, with that sense of social or vocational purpose, or it could be a religious purpose. But at some point, if our human development goes well enough, which is challenging in the contemporary Western world because we live in cultures that actually, you might say, do their best to suppress our full human development. But if we do manage to progress, maybe because we were lucky to have mentors or certain developmental experiences on our own, visionary experiences perhaps, we get to this place where we start realizing that we as human beings are are incredible mystical phenomena ourselves. We're quite magical in a way that our contemporary cultures never speak to us about at all, not the mainstream anyways. And we discover that our own human psyche is this multifaceted, magnificent phenomenon, and that the depths of our own individual psyche and the mysteries of the world are so much more than we had any idea about at all. And then we're getting to the point where we realize that that none of the social or vocational roles that exist in contemporary Western society could possibly define the true majesty and mystery of our individual selves. And then we go on a journey. Joseph Campbell called that moment the call to spiritual adventure. And that call is essentially to what we might say to leave home, not just a physical address, but to leave the story we've been living, to realize that everything we've understood about ourselves and the world and our role in the world is not necessarily wrong, but it's way too small. It's too limited to really define who we are and our possible gift to the world. And at that point, in the mystical traditions, including the Western mystery schools, an individual leaves everyday society. If they don't leave physically, they leave in a social and psychological and spiritual sense. And they go wandering deeper into themselves and into the world in search of something, some deeper spiritual truth. But pause for a moment and say I've discovered over last 30 years of study and guiding and experiencing myself that there's actually two kinds of spiritual realms. And the distinction is almost never made in Western spiritual traditions, or in Eastern spiritual traditions, for that matter. And the indigenous peoples from around the world speak of three worlds, which we can simply call the upper world, the middle world, and the underworld, or the lower world. And the middle world is more like our everyday social life, our jobs and raising children, growing food, and so forth. And tending to the taking care of creation, but the upper world and the underworld are two realms of what in the Western societies we'd call spiritual realms. And the upper world spirituality has to do with the universal, the divine, the sense of what might be called the non-dual traditions, the experiences that help us know that our consciousness is part of a much larger, vast consciousness, which is the very consciousness or imagination of the cosmos. And this is, in the contemporary Western world, we think of spirituality to be that realm, and it is in part, but there's also this other realm, the underworld, which has mostly gotten suppressed by contemporary Western society, primarily because it's dangerous to our contemporary Western society, whereas the upper world is not as much. So the underworld, these two upper and underworld are not in opposition to each other. They're actually quite complementary, and I've come to believe that a full spirituality encompasses both. So the underworld, it goes down rather than up, and it goes into the fruitful darkness rather than the light. And the underworld journey goes not towards what is the universal spirituality, but the unique, the transpersonal unique individual spirituality. It's something much deeper than personality or social role. And in particular, it's our soul identity or our mythopoetic identity. And so at some point, we feel the call from the depths. If we've developed enough psychologically and spiritually and socially, we feel this call from the depths. And it's an invitation, as Joseph Campbell said, to separate from everyday life and wander deeper into the mysteries. And in the traditions that still honor and acknowledge the underworld journey, one leaves one's everyday cultural, social life for at least a month and often for a year or more at a time. It's a very significant break from everyday life, which, of course, is that much more challenging in the Western world, especially if we already have a family and a job and people depend on us and so on. So what my colleagues and I have been doing at Animas Valley Institute now for 33 years is developing contemporary Western versions of the journey to soul, the underworld journey. And we've been learning a whole lot, and we're constantly learning, and we have lifetimes to go, but at least we're making the start of how can contemporary Western people approach the mysterious depths of the soul and go through the experience that I refer to as the journey of soul initiation, which is a very, very different thing than initiation into a particular group, a religious order, a particular way of viewing the world. The goal is not to learn anyone's view of the world, but to discover what the soul that we're born with or born as intends for us in this lifetime.
Yeah, and then let's explore this topic of the call, because I think that's an important piece that is challenging in our culture to really hear or listen to, get or move with the call to do something, to take off, to go into nature, to join a program at Animas Valley. Tell me a bit more about the call in our modern culture now, and how do we hear that, how do we access it, and what are the challenges to act on it?
Yeah, maybe I'll tell you this story of when I first heard the call and recognized what it was in some way and responded to it. It was in my late 20s, I was, I think, 28, and I was a professor of psychology at the State University of New York in Albany, and I was doing research on non-ordinary states of consciousness through biofeedback, brainwave biofeedback, and hypnosis, and meditation, and other things, and I loved the work I was doing, and I was teaching, and I had graduate students, and it was really quite fulfilling, and you might say that was my initial social purpose in life, was to study consciousness and human potential back in the mid-70s, late-70s. And I was in my second year there as a professor in New York State, and I was starting to feel this kind of a queasiness, that there was something that said to me, like, I can't feel how I'm really going to spend my whole life doing this. It just isn't quite it, even though I loved the topic, and my research was going great, and I was publishing the best psychology journals. And, you know, the joke in academia is that you have to publish or perish, and so I was publishing really well, but feeling that on some spiritual level, I was beginning to perish. And, being a wilderness, lover from my teen years on, I took myself out one day in the winter with a pair of snowshoes to climb, do a solo ascent of a mountain in the Adirondacks. And it's a beautiful winter day. When I got to the top, blue sky day, and looking out over this vast expanse of valleys in upstate New York, and I was starting to feel this queasiness again. And then way off in the distance on a bend of a river, you know, miles from the summit of this mountain, there was something glistening or gleaming, and there was something in my psyche that it just took hold of that experience, and I felt that there was this magical thing out there that I had to go look for, and I really couldn't have told you much more than that in that moment, but I realized I had to leave the life I was living, and that this is the call to adventure. And it's a radical call, and it doesn't accept any compromise. And in that moment, I felt this immense emotion come up from my belly that was a combination of two emotions. One was hope, and the other was immense grief. And the grief was for realizing that I had to say goodbye to the life I had been living. Just right out of the blue, in that moment, I realized that. And the hope was that there was a possibility of finding that mystical gleaming thing out in the distance somewhere. And the combination of those two emotions was so powerful, I literally dropped to my knees in the snow and I couldn't stand for a while. But I knew that I had to go down the mountain and resign my faculty position and wander off deeper into the world without a whole lot of guidance. And Chris, that's one of the difficulties for so many people who do hear the call to adventure. And my guess, it's maybe 20% of most of contemporary Western people ever hear that call. But 20% is a lot of people, but very few of those 20% have any guidance, any mentors or spiritual guides to help people go make the descent down as opposed to merely the ascent up. And again, that's what we've been doing at Animus Valley Institute last three decades is beginning to learn how can we support, how can we recognize someone who's heard the call? How can we help people recognize that that's what's happened to them? They're not going crazy. Because that's what people often think, that they must be going entirely insane.
Right, and then their whole worldview is sort of challenged, right? You know, that's kind of the crazy part. I can't do that, and I can't leave my family and this job and all this that I've created. There's a kind of a worldview attachment, right? And how do I let go of that if there's this call emerging in me?
Yeah, and I think of the beginning of one of Mary Oliver's famous poems, which is called The Journey. If I remember correctly, it goes something like, "One day you finally knew what you had to do and began, though the voices around you kept shouting their bad advice, though the whole house began to tremble and you felt the old tug at your ankles. Mend my life," each voice cried. That's just the beginning of the poem, but the house that's trembling is the whole house of belonging that we've had at that point in our life, the way we've understood our life and what we belong to. And we recognize the house is, it's kind of like an earthquake. The whole story is about to collapse. And then we start hearing these voices shouting their bad advice, as Mary Oliver says. And the voices are both inside us and outside us. The inner voices are those parts of us that don't want to take the risk and don't want to lose the familiar and the safe adaptation we have to life. And the outer voices might be our friends, our spouse, our family members, our kids, our employers, and so on, our colleagues, who don't want us to leave the life we've been living because it would be upsetting their life, understandably. So in healthy, mature cultures, which are hard to find anymore on this planet, but they're in a few places and we have historical records of them, the initiatory journey, this mystical initiatory journey, starts in the teen years. It starts before someone is committed to a romantic partner, before someone has started a family, before someone has gotten too far into a particular vocation or craft, when it's relatively easier to do. Whereas in our contemporary Western world, the call to adventure, when it is heard, it tends to be in our late 20s at the earliest. Although the last couple years of our 20s is actually a very common time for it to be heard for the first time. Or we might not hear it to midlife until, let's say, our earlier mid-40s or even later.
I'm noticing that in my own work with men and women, that the midlife question in our culture of who am I, what am I about, what do I want to bring to the world, is a powerful call that's not happening sometimes till 40, 45, 50, mm-hmm. You know, and it's really interesting to see that in some ways that is where I see a breakdown of life, an end of relationship or leaving work. Why do you think that's happening? Is that just the maturity of our Western culture? It takes that long to get to that point, or is it just you know, as David White says, it's just that question of midlife, you know, that we have to ask ourselves. You know, why is it taking so long to get there?
Good question. There's several answers I've heard. Astrologers have their answers of what happens in the early 40s for everybody. Can't remember exactly what it is. It has to do with one of the outer planets, maybe Neptune. And others say that it just takes that long in the Western world to develop psycho-spiritually enough. That's what Carl Jung said. It takes that long. Jungian psychologist James Hollis refers to the first adulthood and the second adulthood, and the journey to soul is what kicks off the, what Hollis calls the second adulthood. And but interestingly, the traditional indigenous people say this journey starts in our teen years. For the Jungians, in the late 40s, or sorry, mid 40s, and maybe for most Westerners, it really never starts at all. Others say that when we're in our early 40s, we're approximately halfway through the expected lifespan of modern people, which is to say we're as close to our ending as we are to our beginning. And so it's just on that level, it's a natural time to start asking the deeper existential questions, if we haven't already, questions about who am I really at my depths? What's my life really about? What is the deeper contribution or gift that I might be able to carry to my people in the world?
And so it kind of begs the question for me, and as I'm sitting in my own life and seeing how other people are navigating their lives, both challenged lives and lives that are, you know, feeling more on purpose for them. My question to you is, why is living from this soul purpose or this soul identity important in today's world? What, give, kind of give us the why, you know, as you see it through your experience with all the people.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's see. I guess the background is that for those of us who've awakened to the crisis on the planet at this time, which is not everybody, but it's becoming increasingly more with as people are experiencing the effects of climate disruption. And, of course, there's people all over the world experiencing the effects of war and poverty and hunger, relatively little in this country, but even in this country, the poverty and the hunger and all kinds of horrible social travesties are increasing all the time. So people are waking up that there's something terribly wrong, and that it's the generations that are alive now that are going to have to make the difference if we're going to survive as a species, or if we're going to be in any kind of decent shape at all by the end of the century. So so many people are waking up in that ecological, environmental, social, cultural sense. And a universal response is for people to ask, well, what can I do? How can I contribute? And a lot of people get wrapped up in this syndrome of I got to do something to save the world, which comes from our heart, and we really want to do that. But we can, you know, really burn out and take too much upon ourselves if we think that we or our small band of friends have to save the world. So, as I'm sure you know, there's many spiritual teachers say that the goal is not to save the world, but to belong to it, to participate with it. And the journey of soul initiation, one way to say what that does, that this mystical journey to our mythopoetic depths, what this journey does is it shows us, it gives us a glimpse of how we were born to belong to the world, and that we just haven't become conscious of yet. So our soul purpose indicates to us what the greatest gift we can offer the world in our lifetime. And it's a service to the world, but it's simultaneously the path to our greatest personal fulfillment. And that's what so many spiritual traditions say, is that what you love most to do, what is most joyous, ecstatic, fulfilling for you, will turn out to be your greatest service to the world anyways, and vice versa. And that soul purpose is so much more in alignment than any pre-soul social purpose can be. And so people who've gone through the initiatory journey, and again, I think it's maybe only 10% of Westerners ever complete it, I refer to those folks as visionary artisans of cultural renaissance or cultural transformation. And they're visionary because the work they're doing is rooted in the depths. It's rooted in a visionary experience of a person's unique soul identity. And to me, those are the leaders we most need at this time. who don't understand what they're, who understand what they're doing, not simply on a social level or a vocational level, but on a mystical soul level.
And this might be a good point then to dive into, Bill, what are the sort of approaches, tools, and ways that you help people navigate to this this possibility of uncovering their soul purpose through an initiatory experience? Maybe just guide us through some of the things you do on your experiences with people. What are some of the tools that you use in that experience?
Yeah, thanks. The first thing to say is that we divide our work into foundational or preparatory work, and then the actual journey to soul is the second part. And most of the people who come to us seem to benefit best at first with some preparatory or foundational work. And the two main branches of that foundational work we call wholing, that's with a W-H-O-L-I-N-G, which is a cultivating our innate human wholeness. And the second branch is self-healing, that's with a capital S on the self, where we learn to heal ourselves from the perspective of our wholeness. And one of the words, synonyms I use for our human wholeness is the self, capital S, the self. So cultivating our wholeness, I've developed a map to help us do that, help us guide the Animus Valiant student to understand what we're doing when we're helping ourselves and others do that. And I've used the four directions map that is found in cultures all over the world, including our own. These are the four cardinal directions, north, south, east, west, which is really the same map as the four times of day, noon, sunset, midnight, and sunrise. And it's the same as the four seasons in the parts of the world that have four seasons. So it's this universal cross-cultural map, and it's been used in traditions all over the world to help us understand the totality of anything. Well, we can use it to understand the totality of ourselves. And so I've divided our human wholeness into these four facets that are mapped onto the four cardinal directions. And I don't know if we'll have time to talk about them much, but just at least in terms of the words we use. The north facet of any human psyche is what we call the nurturing, generative adult. This can also be called the warrior or the lover, the parent or the king or queen, the benevolent king or queen. And in the south is the facet of our wholeness that I call the wild indigenous one. And this is our embodied, emotional, erotic, sexually erotic aspect. And in the east is the what we call the innocent or the sage. This is our the aspect of every human psyche that doesn't get doesn't cling, that is, understands non-attachment and non-duality and humor and lightening up and seeing the big picture about things. And the west facet is, I call it the muse beloved, the muse dash beloved. It's the our deep imagination. It's our romantic erotic aspect, as distinct from the self, physical sexual erotic. So the west is this more magical part of us that's oriented towards the dark, to the undoing of things. And it serves as our onboard guide to soul, guide to the depth. So the foundational work we do at Animus Valley Institute is helping people cultivate through a whole bunch of ceremonies and practices, especially done in relationship to the wild earth, the natural world, to cultivate all four of these facets. Each one of us seems to be born with one facet relatively easy to develop, and the other three more difficult, and one of those three really difficult. And that last most difficult one turns out to be the most important set of capacities for our spiritual journey. Wouldn't you know it? So that's a real brief, the cultivating wholeness. And self-healing is we help ourselves and others through the self-healing work, be in relationship to the wounded parts of our psyche, which we call our subpersonalities. We also map those onto the four directions. So these four categories of wounded aspects of our psyches, everybody has them. Nobody's exempt. And the goal is not to get rid of them, because you can't. It's not possible. If you try to get rid of them, it just makes it worse. The goal is to embrace them from our wholeness, from our maturity, from our creative, nurturing capacities and our emotional, deep imaginative capacities, and to embrace these parts of our woundedness and help them heal from that place and bring them on board to help us do whatever we need to do in the world, whatever we're called to. So this is the foundational work we do at Animus, the wholing, cultivating wholeness, the four facets of wholeness, and doing our own self-healing work. One thing this does is it weans us from dependence on psychotherapists. And everybody, I want everyone to know that I am a psychotherapist, so I have nothing against psychotherapy. But there's so much of our healing we can actually do on our own if we get some guidance in doing that. So that's the foundational work. Sorry, go ahead.
Just one thing in your map, because I've read about this, though. There is another aspect of the map, the vertical. Do you want to just kind of speak to that to complete the visual for the people around the map?
Yeah, great. Thanks for asking,
down,
Chris.
Down in center, right? Yeah.
Yeah, it's a three-dimensional map, and what I just spoke of briefly was the horizontal part, which is, you might say, more the middle world part. But we bring in the three dimensionality by the vertical axis, again, which is found in mystical traditions all around the world, often called the tree of life, the axis mundi. And the upper direction is what I referred to earlier as the upper world, or our relationship to the universal, the vast imagination of the world, the divine, the non-dual, and our own experience of that non-dual consciousness. And the downward direction is the underworld, or the realm of soul, in the mystical image that we were born with. The poet David White uses that as one of his phrases for soul. He speaks of the truth at the center of the image we were born with. To me, that's referring to soul. And it's quite a, I mean, if you take that, I want to say just not just literally, but if you really take that into your heart, into your belly, this idea that we're each born with an image or a symbol, and there's a truth at the center of it. And by the time we become conscious of ourselves at about age 4, we've lost all memory of that image we were born with. And then in the rest of childhood, the job is to become a member of our family and of the natural world. And then in our teen years, it's all about becoming socially accepted and so on. And so by then, we've come a long psychological distance from the truth at the center of the image we were born with. And then that's when, in a healthy culture, the initiators or the elders are watching the youth to see when a young person is beginning to ask these deeper questions about life, and when the door or the window is beginning to open into the depths again. And when the initiators see that, they might say, they grab a hold of the individual and they say, congratulations and we're so sorry, but you have to leave the life you've been living now. It's time for you to go into the initiatory journey. And
it's a scary call to hear for some people, right?
It's called what? Sorry?
It's a scary call for people to hear, you know, in their lives.
It's really scary. And our wounded parts try to convince us it was something else, or it was something we ate, or we drank too much, or we just were having a bad day, and that just keep your head down and continue on whatever trajectory you've been on. So let's see, another phrase from David White. He says, he asked the question, what shape waits in the seed of you to grow and spread its branches against a future sky. That's a journey. I mean, that's a question that shows up at the time of the call to spiritual adventure, or the threshold of the journey to the depths. What shape waits in the seed of you to grow and spread its branches against a future sky? It's kind of borrowing perhaps the image of the acorn, that we each are born with an acorn. Well, an acorn has the possible shape of a giant oak tree in it, but we're each born with some kind of seed like that. And then David White asks in the next couple of lines of that poem, suggest three of the kinds of, actually four places that we might look for that shape. And here they are, these four. He says, he asks us questions. He asks, is it waiting in the fertile sea? Shape that waits in the seed of us. Is it waiting in the fertile sea? In the trees beyond the house. In the one life we can imagine for ourselves. In the open and lovely white page on the waiting desk. So, Chris, I'd love those four images, because what I'm hearing the poet say to us is that there's three categories of places that we'd look for the deepest truth in ourselves. There's at least three. He names three. The first two are in the same category, the fertile sea and the trees beyond the house. Those are two examples of looking in nature, looking in the wilder world. And so, you know, in so many mystical traditions, when one hears the call to adventure, one leaves the home physically in the village and goes wandering into the wild, mostly solo, because it's this ancient intuition that if we wander long enough and deep enough into the more wilder, undomesticated lands, that we one day will glimpse some symbol, some image, some something in the wild world that will resonate so strongly and deeply with our own deepest truth that we'll be able to see our deepest truths out there in the world, in the wilder world. So that's that first category. He gives those examples, the fertile sea and the trees beyond the house. The second one is the one life we can imagine for ourselves. So here he's evoking the deep imagination. So one place that we look for the secret, once we've been called to the adventure, is in our own unconscious, you might say, our dream life, the images that come to us unbidden, which is very, very rich. But so many contemporary people don't have access to this because our innate, wild human imagination has been dampened or squelched by our Western parenting techniques and our educational approaches and many of our mainstream religious approaches and modern entertainment and advertising and so on. And so much of what it seems contemporary people need to do is to re-enliven, reanimate the deep imagination. One reason we do lots of dream work at Animus. And the fourth example he gives, which is the third category, is, he says, the open and lovely white page on the waiting desk. And this, of course, is what a poet, this is the horror and the blessing that a poet wakes up to every single morning. It's because, so he, David White's referring to the implements of our vocation or our craft. For a poet, it's this blank white page that he or she faces in the morning that's saying, you know, fill me with your deep imagination. So that's one way that people find the mystical, mythopoetic identity of their souls is through whatever art or craft they've adopted.
Yeah, beautiful. And I know we're coming toward the end of our time, and I would like to open the space for you to, gosh, I guess what I'd call it is bringing your invitation or your wisdom to the people listening to this. About this stepping into this journey, this soul journey. So maybe just kind of give us a sense of what your invitation and your beckoning is for us.
Well, yeah, let's see if I can try in a few minutes here. One is to really begin to wrestle with this suggestion I'm offering people today, that this journey of soul initiation is something different than you probably know about already, and it's and this idea that we have this mystical image that we're born with, we have this identity that cannot be couched in cultural terms or vocational terms or social terms. I haven't said it yet, but this soul identity is really the same as what could be called our ecological identity. It's what nature wants us to do in nature's terms, not in our cultural terms. So yeah, just beginning to wrestle with this idea that there is this deeper journey, and that our dreams, by the way, our dreams that we have every night, if we're neurologically normal, help us steer our way towards this truth. And again, this foundational work of developing the four facets of our wholeness and beginning to learn to heal ourselves. And so let's see, what else? Of course, I could say that I'd love it for people to check out the programs we offer at Animus Valley Institute. The website is www.animus.org. And Animus is the Spanish word for souls, better pronounced animas. It's A-N-I-M-A-S. I'm emphasizing the A there before the final S because some people think it's the Jungian term animus, but it's not. It's the Spanish term for souls, A-N-I-M-A-S. And let's see, how am I doing, Chris? Am I answering your question, or did you mean it more broadly?
No, I think that's perfect as we wrap up here. I just want to acknowledge that, you know, the core sponsor of this whole summit, the Mankind Project, really is very much aligned with what with a call that you're putting out as the call into an initiatory experience or call into a journey with guides and support. And I know at Animus Valley Institute, that's what you guys are about, is trying to create a modern context of support, of guiding to this deeper journey. And I agree with you. That's very much what's missing in the culture, is as these things are coming up in me, where do I go to find the support, the care, the nurturing to dive in? And it's a challenge in our culture. And as you've said, there's only so many people that are actually called, move into it and complete the journey. My hope is, I'm sure as yours, is that more and more do, embark on that journey to help change our culture and our society from that place.
Indeed, yes.
It's been a beautiful conversation with you, Bill. I so appreciate your wisdom, and I'll share it again for those listening that if you want to learn more about Bill or the Animus Valley Institute and their programs, they have a number of amazing programs. You can go to www.animus.org, A-N-I-M-A-S.org. Particularly check out their Animus Quest and their Soulcraft Intensive. And you can find Bill's books on their website, I'm sure, as well as on Amazon.com. And his latest one is Wild Mind. And that's a lot of what we spoke to today, what Bill spoke to today. So thank you, Bill. It's been a pleasure talking with you. And thanks for being here with us.
Thank you, Chris. It was a real treat having this time with you. Thanks so much.
This concludes this session of the Power of Purpose Summit, recorded in March 2014. For more information on the Power of Purpose Summit, visit powerofpurposesummit.com. And to learn more about our sponsor, the Mankind Project USA, visit mkpusa.org.